Maybe a little. It has all happened before, and as far as Douglas Pavlicek can make out, it will keep happening forever. Prisoner 571, reporting for duty, 4 decades on. They don't ask him much. They don't have to. He has written it all down in painstaking detail in a nightly ritual of memory and explanation. Signed, sealed, delivered. All the crimes the five of them committed. Maidenhair, Watchman, Mulberry, Doug Fir, and Maple. But it's a funny thing. His captors aren't all that interested in forest names. Dorothy shows up in the doorway, the eternally recurring breakfast tray in her arms. Morning, Ray Ray. Hungry? He's awake, tranquil, looking out through the window onto the acre and a half of Brinkman land. He has grown so calm these days. There have been stretches, terrible days, that she was sure would kill him. Last winter was the worst. One February afternoon, she spent minutes trying to hear what he was wailing. When she finally made him out, it was as if he were reading her mind. I'm done. It's hemlock time. But spring brought him back to himself, and in these days near the summer solstice, she'd swear she has never seen him happier. She puts the tray down on the bedside table. How about some peach banana cobbler? He tries to raise his hand, perhaps to point, but the hand has other ideas. When he at last gets his mouth to work, he comes at her out of the blue.
There. That.
The words slur, as pulpy as the hot fruit mush she has made for breakfast. He leads with his eyes.
That. True.
She looks out, her features eager, trying to pretend that the request makes perfect sense. Still the consummate amateur thespian.
Yes?
His mouth opens and he launches a syllable midway between what and who. Her voice stays bright.
What kind? Ray, you know I'm hopeless at that. Some evergreen? From when?
Two words, like biking uphill on a muddy mountain trail. She gazes at the tree as if she has never laid eyes on it.
Good question.
For a moment she can't remember how long they've lived in this place, or what they've planted. He flails a little, but not in distress.
Let's see.
Then she's standing in front of a wall of books. Ceiling to floor, their lifetime hoard of print. She puts her palm on a shoulder-high shelf, wood she can't name. Her finger flicks the dusty spines, looking for a thing she's not sure is there. The past tries to kill her, all the people they were or had hoped to be. She skips by 100 hikes in the Yellowstone. She pauses on A Field Guide to Eastern Songbirds, as something bright and red in her head flies off, unidentified. The slender thing, almost a pamphlet, skulks near the end of the shelf.
Easy Tree IDs.
She takes down the book. An inscription on the title page ambushes her. For my dear first dimension, my sole and only dot. Care to see which trees are clear and which are clearly not? She has never seen the words before, not even a vague memory of any attempt to learn the names of trees together. But the poem brings back the poet intact, the best, worst poet in the world. She flips the pages. Way more oaks than good taste would recommend. Red, yellow, white, black, gray, scarlet, iron, live, burr, valley, and water. With leaves that deny all relation to each other. She remembers now why she never had the patience for nature. No drama, no development, no colliding hopes and fears. Branching, tangled, messy plots. And she could never keep the characters straight. She reads the inscription again. How old was the jingle writer?
Best worst poet.
Best worst actor. Patent and copyright lawyer who drove cheats into bankruptcy, then spent a tenth of each year doing pro bono. He wanted a large family for the all-night Crazy Eights marathons and the four-part novelty songs on long car trips. Instead, it was only him and his dear First Dimension. She carries the booklet back to his room.
Ray, look what I found!
The howling mask of his face seems almost pleased.
When did you give this to me?
Nice we held on to it, huh? Just what we need now. Ready? He's worse than ready. He's a kid on his way to camp.
Start here. If you live east of the Rocky Mountains, go to entry 1. If you live west of the Rocky Mountains, go to entry 116.
She looks at him. His eyes are damp, but traveling.
If your tree produces cones and has needle-like leaves, go to entry 11C.
They both look out the window, as if the answer hasn't been staring at them for the last quarter century. In the noonday light, the world bows, stout and layered at wide intervals, shine a funny bluish silver she has never noticed. The tapered, narrow spire shimmers in the overhead sun.
Definite yes on the needles. Cones up top, too.
Raymond, I believe we may be on to something. She flips through the pages to the treasure hunt's next way station.
Are the needles evergreen and arranged in sheathed bundles of 2 to 5 needles each? If yes, go to...
She looks up. His mask smirks now, more than it should be able to. The eyes are alight.
Adventure. Excitement. Goodbye. Travel well. Be right back.
The smallest packet of surprise lodges at the top of her chest. Like that, she's off. She retreats through the kitchen into the back pantry, a warren of cubbies cluttered with decades of set it and forget it. Some weekend she'll sort through the ancient junk, pitch it all, lighten the lifeboat for the last few nautical miles. The back door opens, and she smells the waves of grassy summer rolling over her. She has no shoes. The neighbors will think she has lost her mind caring for her brain-damaged husband. And if she has, well then, that's the story. She crosses the lawn, takes the lowest branch in her hand, bends it toward her, and counts. There's a song about this, she thinks, a song or a prayer, or a story, or a film. The branch slips upward from her hand. She drifts back to the house over the sun-ghosted grass, humming the tune that is about exactly this moment. He's waiting for her, hanging on the denouement.
5 in a sheath. We're on a roll.
She flips through the book to the next unfolding branch.
Are the cones long with thin scales?
This splitting and choosing, she recognizes it. It's like the law. Those cases she transcribed during all those years when she played a court stenographer. The evidence, the cross-examinations, messy negotiations and manufactured facts, the path narrowing in on a sole-allowable verdict. It's like evolution's decision tree. If the winters are tough and the waters scarce, try scales or needles. It's even, weirdly, like acting. If you need to respond with fear, go to gesture 21C. If wonder, 17A. Otherwise, it's a programmed telephone support system for living on Earth. It's the mind moving through mysteries, their explanations forever one more choice away. More than anything, it's like the tree itself, with one central questioning stem splitting into dozens of probing ones, and each of those forking into hundreds, then thousands of green and independent answers.
Stay tuned,
Dorothy says, and disappears again. Once more, the back door's black enamel knob protests, squeaking in her hand. She makes her way across the yard to the tree. A short journey, repeated ad nauseam more times than anyone ever signs on for, across the same patch of familiar ground. The path of love. If you want to keep fighting, turn to entry 1001. If you want to break loose and save yourself... She stands under the tree and studies the cones. They cover the ground, spores that crash to earth from some remote asteroid. Then back to the house with her answer. The way across the wet grass and stocking feet is long enough for her to wonder how she can still be here, buried alive, tied to this frozen man year after year, when all she ever wanted in this life was to find her freedom. But back in the prison doorway, waving the book in triumph, she knows. This is her freedom. This one. The freedom to be equal to the terrors of the day. Victory! Eastern White Pine! She'd swear a great wave of contentment sweeps across the rigid face. She can read him now, with a telepathy honed by years of having to guess at his clotted syllables. He's thinking, a good day's work, a very good day. That night he makes her read to him about a tree that once ran in great vertical veins of living ore from Georgia to Newfoundland, out through Canada, and past the Great Lakes to where they camp out together by lamplight. She tells him about giants 4 feet wide, their trunks shooting 80 feet straight up before the first sideways branches bothered to extend. Trees that stood in endless stands that darkened the air with pollen each spring, the clouds of golden dust raining down on the decks of ships far out at sea. She reads to him of how the English first swarmed a continent that rose from the ocean overnight, seeking masts for their leviathan frigates and ships of the line, masts that no place in all stripped Europe, not even the farthest boreal north, could any longer provide. She shows him paintings of Pinus strobus, in hulking shafts as big as church steeples, so valuable that the crown branded even those that stood on private land with the king's broad arrow. And her husband, who spent his life protecting private property, must see it coming, even from the future, the Pine Tree Riot. Revolution. War. Fought over a thing that grew on these shores long before humans came down out of trees. It's a story to match any fiction. The well-wooded land, succumbing to prosperity. The light, soft, strong, dimensioned boards, sold back across the ocean as far away as Africa. The triangular profit making the infant country's fortune. Lumber to the Guinea coast, black bodies to the Indies, sugar and rum back up to New England, with its stately mansions all built of eastern white pine. White pine framing out cities, making millions in sawmill fortunes, laying a bed of rails across the continent, building and pitching warships and whaling fleets that wander out from Brooklyn and New Bedford into the unmapped South Pacific, ships made of 1,000 trees or more. The white pines of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota split into 100 billion roof shingles. 100 million board feet a year, splintered into matchsticks. Scandinavian lumberjacks clearing a swath of pine 3 states wide, wrestling the colossal husks into rivers with tackle and boom, riding miles-long rafts of them downstream to market. A giant hero and his big blue ox cutting the pine to clear the Brinkman's neighborhood. Dorothy reads, and the wind picks up. All the yard bends with complaint. Rain blows in. The small room grows smaller still. Night, the third part of every day that remains a foreign country. the house next door vanishes, and the ones just north of that, until the Brinkmans huddle up alone, out on the edge of a savage wilderness. Ray's working leg thrashes against the sheets that hem him in. All he ever wanted was to earn an honest living, promote the general welfare, earn the respect of his community, and raise a decent family. Wealth needs fences. But fences need wood. Nothing left on the continent even hints at what has gone. All replaced now by thousands of miles of continuous backyards and farms with thin lines of second growth between them. Still, the soil remembers for a little while longer the vanished woods and the progress that unmade them. And the soil's memory feeds their backyard pine. Spittle wells on Ray's trembling lips. It stays there until Dorothy wipes it off, sometime before midnight. The lips move as she wipes them. She leans in and thinks she hears him whisper, "One more. Tomorrow." The night is warm. The windows of Patricia's cabin bang in the breeze, and the sturgeon moon rises over the lake like a pale red penny. She rests her palms on the stack of notebooks filled with her careful hand. "Well, then, I believe we may finally be done." There's no answer tonight, as there never is. The words do no more than hang in the air. Plenty of creatures here, inside the cabin and out. Her syllables answer and change the various chirps, groans, sighs, plans, and estimates that punctuate this night. The conversation is long, patient, beyond any party's ability to follow, and the patterned noises her kind add to it are still brand new. She listens for a moment to the hour's alarms. Then she pushes down against the walnut table. Her legs straighten, and she rises. She flips open the uppermost notebook to the page where she has just written, "In a world of perfect utility, we too will be forced to vanish." "You're sure this is a good idea?" she asks herself. She asks the dead man. The membrane between the two is thin. She knows she'll never see him again in this or any life to come. Yet she sees him wherever she looks. That's life. The dead keep the living alive. Every other night she asks her missing friend for words and phrases, for courage, for enough forbearance to keep from pitching her notes into the wood-burning stove. Now, the asking is done. She flips the page. "No one sees trees. We see fruit, we see nuts, we see wood, we see shade. We see ornaments or pretty fall foliage. Obstacles blocking the road or wrecking the ski slope. Dark, threatening places that must be cleared. We see branches about to crush our roof. We see a cash crop. But trees, trees are invisible."
"It's not bad, then. A little bleak, maybe."
Short, too, she might add. Far smaller than her firstborn. There's so much more to tell, but she's an old woman now, without much time, and there are so many more species still to find and take aboard the Ark. The book is a simple enough story. She could have told it in a page or two. How she and several others spent years traveling to all the continents but Antarctica. How they saved a few seeds from a few thousand trees, a fraction of the species that will vanish as the Earth's current custodians watch, bringing countless dependents down with them. She has tried to hold out hope, to tell every story that might make the truth a little easier. She gives a whole chapter to migration. She describes all the trees already marching north at rates that astonish those who measure them. But the most vulnerable trees will need to move much faster to keep from burning up, They can't cross highways or farms or housing developments. Maybe we can help them. She spins short biographies of her favorite characters, loner trees, cunning trees, sages and solid citizens, trees that turn impulsive or shy or generous, as many ways of being as there are forest elevations and facings. How fine it would be if we could learn who they are, when they're at their best. She tries to turn the story on its head. This is not our world with trees in it. It's a world of trees where humans have just arrived. One passage keeps springing back, every time fear or scientific rigor makes her prune it. Trees know when we're close by. The chemistry of their roots and the perfumes their leaves pump out change when we're near. When you feel good after a walk in the woods, it may be that certain species are bribing you. So many wonder drugs have come from trees, and we haven't yet scratched the surface of the offerings. Trees have long been trying to reach us, but they speak on frequencies too low for people to hear. She's up from the table with a groan meant for no one. In the front closet, she finds the stack of nested cardboard boxes that she and Dennis always had such trouble throwing out. Moldy boxes, saved for decades. Who knows when you might need one exactly this size? The notebooks fit, as if by design. She'll mail them to an assistant tomorrow for typing. Then to her editor in New York, who has been waiting for years for a follow-up to a book that's still in print, still selling, still weighing on Patricia's conscience for its cost in pines. As soon as she seals the carton with packing tape, she cracks it open again. The last line of the last chapter is still wrong. She looks at what she has, although the sentence has long since burned itself into permanent memory. With luck, some of those seeds will remain viable, inside controlled vaults in the side of a Colorado mountain, until the day when watchful people can return them to the ground. She purses her lips and pens an addendum. If not, other experiments will go on running themselves long after people are gone.
That's probably better, she says out loud. Right?
But the ghost has finished dictating tonight. When the box is set to go, she gets ready for bed. Ablutions are quick, and grooming even faster. Then the reading, her nightly 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf. When her eyes won't stay open any longer, she finishes with verse. Tonight's poem is Chinese. Wang Wei, 1,200 years old. From an anthology of poetry she winds through at random, the way she likes to hike. I know no good way to live, and I can't stop getting lost in my thoughts, my ancient forests. You ask, how does a man rise or fall in this life? The fisherman's song flows deep under the river. Then the river is running over her, and she's done. She douses the dim low-watt bulb clipped to the headboard. All that's left her is the moon. She rolls on her side and curls up, her face pressed into the dank pillow. After a minute, the end of her mouth pulls into an abiding smile.
I did not almost forget. Good night.
Good night. Adam in Zuccotti Park, Lower Manhattan. This time the fieldwork comes to him. The forces he has been studying his entire professional life are loose again and partying in the heart of the financial district, a few blocks south of where he works and lives. The park is buzzing. The squared circles of honey locusts already tint yellow, and all underneath them, sleeping bags and tents make camp between the skyscrapers. Hundreds slept here last night, as they have for days, They fall asleep to songs of protest and wake to the free hot meal served by 5-star chefs donating their efforts to the cause. Only Adam isn't sure what the cause is. The cause is a work in progress. Justice for the 99%. The jailing of financial traitors and thieves. An eruption of fairness and decency on all continents. The overthrow of capitalism. A happiness not born of rape and greed. The city prohibits all amplified sound, but the human megaphone is in full swing. One woman chants, and the people all around her pick up the words. Banks got bailed out. Banks got bailed out. We got sold out. We got sold out. Occupy. Occupy. Whose streets? Whose streets? Our streets. Our streets. Still the resolutely young, keeping true to the world-saving dreams of their youth. But among the ethnic vests and backpacks are men older than Adam. In breakout sessions around the square, women in their 60s pass along the institutional memory of insurgents. People in leotards pedal stationary bikes to generate electricity for the occupation's laptops. Barbers give away free haircuts, since the bankers seem unwilling to get theirs cropped. People in Guy Fawkes masks hand out leaflets. College kids stand in a ring and drum. Lawyers behind flimsy card tables donate legal advice. Someone has been hard at work defacing signs. No skateboarding, rollerblading, or bicycling allowed in the park. Otherwise, all good, bro. And what's a circus without a band? A whole battalion of guitars, one with the inscription, "This machine kills day traders," joins together in a chorus of high lonesome. For the police make it hard wherever I may go, 'cause I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Just beyond the square's far corner is the wound that won't heal. The hole in the canopy has long since filled in, but it still oozes. A decade has passed since the buildings fell. The math astounds Adam. His own son is only 5, but the attacks feel younger. A tree, a calorie pear that survived, half-burned and with roots snapped, has just returned in good health to ground zero. He squeezes through a channel in the milling crowd alongside the People's Library. He can't help grazing the shelves and bins. There's Milgram's Obedience to Authority, marked up with a million tiny marginal words. There's a collection of Tagore, lots of Thoreau, and even more copies of You versus Wall Street. Free circulation on the honor system. Smells like democracy to him. 6,000 books, and out of them all, one small volume floats up to the surface of its heap like a fossil coughed out of a peat bog. The Golden Guide to Insects. Bright yellow, the only real edition that classic ever had. In shock, Adam picks it up and opens to the title page, ready to see his own name gouged there in smudgy number 2 all-caps balloons. But the name is someone else's, inked in Palmer Method cursive. Raymond B. The pages stink of mildew and the purity of child science. Adam flips through, recalling everything. The field notebooks and home natural history museum. The pond scum under the cheap child's microscope. Above all, the daubs of fingernail polish on the abdomens of ants. Somehow, he has managed to spend his entire life repeating that experiment. He lifts his eyes from the miniature page, weevils and caddisflies, to watch this happy, furious, anarchic swarm. For a few seconds he sees the system of ranks and duties, the waggle dances, the trails of pheromone that feel from inside the hive like pure physics, the pull of gravity. He wants to paint them all with a daub of polish and climb up 40 floors in the next-door high-rise for a better look. The look of a real field scientist. The look of a 10-year-old. He sticks the golden guide into his pants pocket and ducks back into the crowd. 10 steps down, seated on the edge of a granite slab bench, a ghost swings its face toward him and startles. "Occupy!" someone shouts into the human megaphone, and the word comes 100 times louder out the other end. "Occupy!" The ghost's surprise turns into a grin. Adam knows the guy like it's his brother back from the dead. The man he sees is balding in a baseball cap, where the one he remembers had a luxurious ponytail. He can't for the life of him say who the man is. Then he can, and he doesn't want to. It's too late for anything but to walk up and clasp the intruder by the forearm, laughing at the evidence, like luck is such a rascal and the strange old story will lurch forever on. Doug Fir.
Maple! Whoa! This can't be real!
They embrace like 2 old men already over the finish line.
Jesus! Man, life is long, huh?
Longer than anyone. The psychologist can't stop shaking his head. He doesn't want this. The corpse being pulled up out of the tumulus by brutal archaeologists is not him. But the run-in is funny, somehow. Chance, that comedian with the perfect timing.
Is this... Are you here for...
Adam waves toward the teeming crowd saving mankind from itself. Pavlicek.
Pavlicek, the name is.
Pavlicek wrinkles up his eyebrows and scouts the square, like he's just seeing it this moment.
Ah, nah, man, not me. I'm just a spectator these days. Don't get out much. Haven't made a peep since, you know.
Adam takes the man, still gawky, still adolescent, by the bony elbow.
Let's walk.
They stroll down Broadway, past Citibank, Ameritrade, Fidelity. The years they need to catch up on are done in a New York minute. Professor of psychology at NYU, with wife who publishes self-help books, and 5-year-old son who wants to be a banker when he grows up. Longtime BLM employee, between jobs and residences, here in town to see his friend. The end. But they keep walking, under the spire of Trinity Church, passing near the ghost of the buttonwood tree, that sycamore where businessmen once met to trade stock, now the site of Free Enterprise's main engine room. And they keep talking, a slow circle around the past, whose circumference Adam won't be able to retrace even an hour later. Douglas keeps touching the brim of the baseball cap, like he's tipping it to passers-by. Adam asks, "Are you in touch with anyone?"
"In touch?"
"With the others."
Douglas fiddles with the cap.
"No. You?"
"I... No. Mulberry? No idea. But Watchman?" This sounds crazy. It's like he's following me around.
Douglas stops on the sidewalk in a sea of businessmen.
"What does that mean?"
"I'm probably nuts, but I travel a lot for the job, lectures and conferences all over the country, and in at least 3 cities. I've seen street art that looks just like those drawings he used to make."
"The tree people?"
"Yeah. You remember how weird..."
Douglas nods, fingering the brim. A group of tourists ring the sidewalk in front of them around a wild animal. Its huge, muscular, charging nostrils flared, with long, wicked horns ready to gore the throng, ringing it and taking selfies. 7,000 pounds of bronze gorilla art, trucked in by its maker in the dead of night, and left on the stoop of the stock exchange as a gift to the public.
When the city tried to haul it away, people objected.
The Trojan bull.
A few short weeks ago, a ballerina riding the beast bareback in mid-pirouette became the stunning poster child of the latest Stop the Humans movement.
What is our one demand? Hashtag Occupy Wall Street. Bring tent.
People take turns buddying up for a picture with the charging animal. Douglas doesn't seem to get the irony. His eyes are everywhere except where the crowd is looking. Something fights out of him.
So, he rubs his neck, you have a pretty good life now.
Crazy lucky, though I work long hours. The research is a pleasure.
What exactly do you research?
Adam has performed the soundbite thousands of times, for everyone from anthology editors to strangers on airplanes. But this man, he owes this man a little more.
I was working on the topic already when we met, when the five of us... The focus has changed over the years, but it's the same basic problem.
What keeps us from seeing the obvious? Douglas puts his hand to the brass bull's horn.
And? What does?
Mostly other people.
You know,
Douglas looks up Broadway to see what so enrages the bull.
I may have hit upon that idea independently.
Adam laughs so loud the tourists turn to look. He remembers why he loved the man once, why he trusted him with his life. There's a more interesting part of the question.
How some people manage to see?
Exactly. With a gesture, an Asian tourist asks the two men to step away from the statue for the length of a quick photo. Adam nudges Douglas, and they walk some more down into the teardrop of Bowling Green Park.
I've thought a lot, Douglas says, about what happened.
Me too. Right away, Adam wants to retract the lie.
What were we hoping to accomplish? What did we think we were doing?
They stand under the circle of camouflaged platanus, that most resigned of eastern trees, on the spot where the island was sold by people who listened to trees to people who cleared them. They gaze together at the geyser fountain. Adam says, we set buildings on fire.
We did.
We believed that humans were committing mass murder.
Yes.
No one else could see what was happening. Nothing was going to stop unless people like us forced the issue. The beak of Douglas's ball cap swings back and forth.
We weren't wrong, you know. Look around. Anyone paying attention knows the party's over. Gaia's taking her revenge.
Gaia? Adam smiles, but pained.
Life. The planet. We're already paying. But even now, a guy is still a lunatic for saying as much.
Adam assesses the man. So, you'd do it all again, what we did? The questions of rogue philosophers play in Adam's head, the taboo ones. How many trees equal one person? Can an impending catastrophe justify small, pointed violence?
Do it again? I don't know. I don't know what that means.
Burn buildings.
I ask myself at nights whether anything we did, anything we could have done, would ever make up for that woman's death.
And then, it's like the day is night, the city a spruce pine woods, the park all on fire around them, and that fine, strange, pale woman is lying on the ground begging for water. We accomplished nothing, Adam says. Not one thing. They turn to leave the park, a place too crowded for this conversation. At the gate in the low iron fence, only then do they realize
There's no place safer.
She would have done it all again.
Douglas points at Adam's chest.
You loved her.
We all loved her. Yes.
You were in love with her. Same as Watchman. Same as Mimi.
It was a long time ago.
You would have bombed the Pentagon for her.
Adam smiles, soft and pale. She did have a power.
She said the trees were talking to her, that she could hear them.
A shrug. A furtive watch check. He needs to get back uptown to prep a lecture. Too much history sickens Adam. So he was younger once, angrier. Another species, just a failed experiment. The only thing that needs negotiation is now. Douglas won't leave him be.
Do you think anything was really talking to her? Or was she just...
The world had 6 trillion trees when people showed up. Half remain. Half again more will disappear in 100 years. And whatever enough people say that all these vanishing trees are saying is what, in fact, they say. But the question interests Adam. What did the dead Joan of Arc hear? Insight or delusion? Next week, he'll tell his undergrads about Durkheim, Foucault, crypto-normativity. How reason is just another weapon of control. How the invention of the reasonable, the acceptable, the sane, even the human, is greener and more recent than humans suspect. Adam casts a look behind them, down the concrete canyon of Beaver Street. Beavers, the creatures whose pelts built this city, the original Manhattan Exchange. He hears himself answer, "Trees used to talk to people all the time. Sane people used to hear them." The only question is whether they'll talk again before the end.
That night, Douglas lifts his face to the skyscraper wall, when we sent you for help, why did you come back?
Anger surges through Adam, as if the two of them will fight again. It was too late. Finding help would have taken hours. She was dead already. If I'd gone to the police, she'd still be dead, and we'd all be locked up.
You didn't know that, man. You don't know that now.
Rage, the radical tip of a grief that time will never root out. They pass a small European redbud, 20 feet tall. Its spine arches, and its limbs curve like those of the ballerina bull dancer. The profusion of purple-pink edible buds growing right out of the trunk and twigs is still a winter away. Now seed pods dangle from the branches like so many hanged men. They say Judas hanged himself from a Circus. It's a new enough myth, as tree myths go. Judas trees grow in corners hidden throughout Lower Manhattan. This one will be gone before it blooms twice more. The men stop at Battery Place, where their paths split, down the street and across the water, Liberty. There's a certain squirrel, a ghost animal, the subject of endless eulogies, who runs forever through the canopies of a giant ghost forest from here to the Mississippi, without ever touching paws to the ground. It's all island-hopping now, through scattered fragments of second growth, subtended by highways littered with roadkill. But the men stop to look, as if the endless forest still starts there, in front of them. They turn to one another and hug goodbye, like bears testing their strength against each other, like they'll never see each other again in this life, like even then it would be too soon. The trees refuse to say a thing. Neelay sits in Stanford's inner quad, the intergalactic botanical garden, waiting for an explanation. The lifelong calling has gone wrong. He's lost the trail they set him on. What now? But the trees snub him. The bulging water sack of the bottle tree, the spiked armor of the silk floss, not even a rustle of leaves. It's as if his soulmate, in the only galaxy that ever offered him one, has plunged from bliss to panic at the first ripple and cut him dead. He's ruining tourists' photographs. No one wants a shot of a nice, fake, Spanish-Romanesque cloister with a crippled freak in the foreground. He spins to go, as furious as any jilted lover. But go where? Even returning to his apartment above the Semper Virens headquarters is a humiliation. He'd call his mother, but it's the middle of the night in Bansuara, where she now spends most of her year getting ready to die. She knows now, 10 years too late, that there will never be any Rupal for him, that science will never reactivate his legs, and that the best way to love her son is to release him to his isolation. She comes back now only whenever he's hospitalized, when the doctors must debride his epic bed sores or cut away parts of his necrotic feet and ass. Boarding a plane has become an exercise in pain. He won't tell her the next time he goes in. He rolls down into the oval toward the grandiose line of palms. The sky is too clear, the day too hot, and all the trunks have turned to synchronized sundials. He finds a shady spot, an increasingly popular sport worldwide. Then he sits still, trying to be only where he is, here, home. No good. In a minute he's agitated, checking his phone for messages not yet posted to him. Where can people live? His elves must be right. Only in symbols, in simulation. As he puts the device back in its wheelchair pouch, it buzzes like a fistful of cicadas. It's a message from his personal AI. The thing is alive, cagey, teasing him with the clickbait game of humanity. Since childhood, even before his fall, he has dreamed of such a robot pet. This one is better than anything the prophets of his childhood sci-fi predicted. Faster, sleeker, and suppler. It goes out at all hours and scours humankind's entire activity, then reports back to him. It's obedient and untiring. And like the only creatures that he trusts these days, it has no legs. Legs, Nile suspects, may be where evolution went berserk. He and his people made the pet, and now it's busy making him. He told it to watch for any news of his new obsession, tree communication, forest intelligence, fungal networks, Patricia Westerford, The Secret Forest. The book is shot through with uncanny echoes of what he heard whispered decades ago by alien life forms that now won't give him the time of day. It has cost him his role as the creative head of his company. It wants more from him, more payment, more salvage. But what? He opens the message from the bot. It contains a link and a title. Words of Air and Light. The recommendation strength is as high as his pet gives. Even in his spot of shade, Nile can't read the screen. He rolls to the van, parked not far away. Back inside his emptied-out interstellar ship, he clicks on the link and watches in confusion. Shadows and sun burst forth. 100 years of chestnut erupt in 20 seconds, like a scene in a hand-cranked kinetoscope. It's over before Nile makes it out. He starts the clip again. The tree fountains up once more into a crown. The upward-wavering twigs reach for the light, for things hidden in plain sight. Branches fork and thicken in the air. At this speed, he sees the tree's central aim, the math behind the phloem and xylem, the intermeshed and seething geometries, and that thin layer of living cambium swelling outward. Code, wildly branching code pruned back by failure, builds up this great spiraling column from out of instructions that Vishnu managed to cram into something smaller than a boy's fingernail. When the tree is done with its century of unfolding, old chestnut words of extinct transcendentalism scroll upward, line by line, on a sea of black. The gardener sees only the gardener's garden. The eyes were not made for such groveling uses as they are now put to and worn out by, but to behold beauty now invisible. May we not see God? And when Nile looks up from the tiny screen, that's exactly what he sees. Just across campus from his van, beyond the eucalyptus groves, invitations go out. They disperse in clumps, like airborne pollen. One lands on Patricia Westerford, in a cabin in an institute in the Great Smoky Mountains. She's searching out prime strains of the dozens of hardwoods that may fall in a few years to the ash borer and long-horned beetles. These days, such invitations reach her by the dozens, and she mostly ignores them. But this one, home repair, countering a warming world. This one sounds so painful that she reads the letter twice. Someone wants to fly her 2,596 miles and back again for a conference about the ruined atmosphere. She can't wrap her head around that title. Home repair. As if we just need to fix the gutters, put in a rooftop swamp cooler, and get back to good times. She sits on her shaker chair at the table, listening to the crickets. Long ago, her father taught her an old formula, one that converts cricket chirps per minute into degrees Fahrenheit. For 60 years, the nighttime orchestra all around her has been playing one of those folk dances that keep speeding up until all the players tumble in a heap. We would be thrilled if you could talk about any role trees might play in helping mankind to a sustainable future. The conference organizers want a keynote from a woman who once wrote a book on the power of woody plants to restore the failing planet. But she wrote that book decades ago, when she was still young enough for courage, and the planet still well enough to rally. These people need dreams of technological breakthrough. Some new way to pulp poplar into paper while burning slightly fewer hydrocarbons. Some genetically altered cash crop that will build better houses and lift the world's poor from misery. The home repair they want is just a slightly less wasteful demolition. She could tell them about a simple machine needing no fuel and little maintenance, one that steadily sequesters carbon, enriches the soil, cools the ground, scrubs the air, and scales easily to any size. A tech that copies itself and even drops food for free. A device so beautiful, it's the stuff of poems. If forests were patentable, she'd get an ovation. California means 3 days of lost work. Jesus spent less time cleaning out hell. Her agoraphobia has grown over the years, and in those crowded auditoriums she can never hear anyone. But the guest list is incredible. A roll call of wizards and engineers, each of them only one large grant away from dimming the sun with particulates, cloning endangered species, or tapping into unlimited cheap energy. There will be artists and writers to address the messy question of the human spirit, venture capitalists looking for the next green bonanza. She'll never have such an audience again. She rereads the request, picturing a place where sustainable future means something more than dry drunk. She reads through to the letter's stirring closing. As Toynbee once wrote, man achieves civilization as a response to a challenge in a situation of special difficulty, which rouses him to make a hitherto unprecedented effort. The invitation feels like a test of the honesty she has tried to cultivate since her days as a hobo. Someone is asking her what people need to do to save this dying place. Could she possibly tell a gathering of such prominent and powerful people what she thinks is true? Too late tonight for a wise reply. There's still time, though, for a wander down to the rapids of the Middle Prong. Outside her cabin door, dense, slow-growing hawthorns wave spooky prophecies under the near-full moon. Their scarlet fruits cling to the twigs, and many will last the winter. Crategus, the heart healer. People will be discovering medicines there for as long as they go on looking. Her path across the clearing frightens a wallow-rooting possum who rode off humankind 2 hours ago. She waves the flashlight. The forest floor is piled high with orange and ochre duff, smelling of sweet, moldy cake batter. 2 barred owls, lugubrious and beautiful, call across a great distance. Up the ridge, acorns and hickories hit the ground. Bears everywhere sleep off the day's feast, 2 per square mile. She ducks through drooping rhododendron tunnels, along black cherries that remember old road cuts, past sourwoods and aromatic sassafras. Magnolia and striped maple fill in for the decimated chestnuts. The hemlocks are dying, hit by adelgids and helped along by acid rain. High above, on the Appalachian spine, the Fraser firs are all dead. All around her, the forest reels from the hottest, driest year since the beginning of record-keeping. Yet another freak once-in-a-century event, almost annual these days. Fires are popping up all over the park, code red every third day. But the priestly tulip trees still boost her immune system, while beeches lift her mood and focus her thoughts. Under these giants, she's smarter, clearer. She sees an alligator-barked persimmon. Sweet gum balls, like tiny medieval morning stars, crunch under her feet. She tears just the tip of a fallen gum leaf and sniffs. A child's whiff of heaven. There's a venerable red oak not far from the trail, 12 feet around if it's a foot. It might soothe even the awful restlessness the invitation has inflicted on her. Sustainable future. They don't want a tree woman to keynote their gathering. They want a master illusionist, a sci-fi novelist, the Lorax. Maybe a colorful faith healer with epiphytes for hair. Down in the riverbed, at her favorite scramble, she removes her shoes. But she doesn't need to. A stream that should be raging is just a boulder bed. She turns a few stones in search of salamanders. 30 possible species, countless millions of them in the park, inhabiting every spot of dampness, and she can't find one. She holds her bare feet in the imaginary current. What do you think, then? Go talk? Home repair? The memory of a hand rests on her shoulder.
If you have to ask me, babe, you can't afford the answer.
From Streamside on Tennessee's Little River to New York City is a mere 700 miles. Pollen from an eastern white pine could travel it, given a good stiff breeze. At the far end of that route, Adam Appich looks out with puzzled smile across the bowl of 260 first-year psych students listening to his lecture on cognitive blindness, to see an armed trio at the back of the auditorium waiting for him to finish. His shock lasts no longer than a few spiked